From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the response in the Islamic world to the defeat of the Taliban with Bernard Lewis, author of What Went Wrong, Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response. Lewis is professor emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Then we consider what would make a young American join the Taliban with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, an expert on extremist religions and cults. And linguist Jeff Nunberg offers some choices for Word of the Year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. U.S. Special Forces are staying in the Tora Bora region for the time being, but a tribal commander says they may leave soon following the path of tribal Afghan fighters who are pulling out their artillery and heavy weapons. It's a sign that the worst of the fighting may be over. The Americans are likely to continue to comb the caves for stragglers and evidence. Still no sign of Osama bin Laden. In the Afghan city of Kandahar, officials have installed security guards in a hospital ward occupied by 9 wounded al-Qaeda fighters. The men were admitted to the hospital with bullet wounds shortly before the Taliban surrendered in Kandahar. From Kandahar, the BBC's Susanna Price reports.
The al-Qaeda fighters are currently under guard in a secure ward in Kandahar's main hospital. They're said to be armed with grenades and guns. The men were among a larger group who arrived at the hospital shortly before the Taliban surrendered the city. They were suffering from various bullet and shrapnel injuries. Doctors said it was unclear how they managed to smuggle their weapons into the hospital. The fighters who were less seriously wounded vanished from the city once the Taliban left, leaving the others behind. The hospital's head nurse, Ghulam Mohammed Afghan, said on Sunday the men were moved to the high-security detention ward, although he had no more details about how this took place. He said his staff had been extremely concerned about their safety while dealing with the fighters, some of whom are thought to have come from Sudan or Yemen.
The BBC's Susanna Price. The World Health Organization reports the deadly Ebola virus continues to spread in the West African country of Gabon. The death toll now stands at 13, with another 6 people suspected of having the virus. Lisa Schlein reports.
Ebola is a highly contagious disease, and local Gabonese officials are trying to contain the spread of the disease by restricting movements in and out of the affected region. But WHO spokesman Gregory Hartle says there are reports of people leaving Gabon for neighboring Congo.
It's natural for people to move around. So we've seen this, obviously, in any situation and in previous outbreaks. People move for a number of reasons. It might be social, economic reasons, or because there has been talk of an outbreak.
An international team of experts is working with authorities in Gabon and Congo to try to trace anyone who may have had contact with any of the Ebola victims. Hartle says special isolation units are being set up in hospitals for anyone suspected of carrying the virus. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Federal health officials are offering the anthrax vaccine to thousands of Capitol Hill and postal workers who might have been exposed to the bacteria. It's a precaution in case any anthrax spores still lurk in their lungs. They're also being offered an extra 40 days of antibiotics. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 106 points. The Nasdaq was up 17. The S&P 500 rose 8. This is NPR News. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat closed 6 Hamas offices today. It's part of his effort to crack down on militant groups. Israel, meanwhile, rounded up 10 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Arafat has said his security forces have detained 180 militants, but Israel charges that no leaders have been picked up. U.S. oil prices rose slightly today after OPEC producers said they would meet late this month to discuss supply cuts. Crude futures inched up on signs OPEC and non-aligned producers would finally complete a deal to pull 2 million barrels a day from the world market. Despite today's hike in futures prices, gasoline prices at the pump continue to fall. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
It's the 13th straight week that gas prices have dropped. The Energy Department reports this past week they've dipped another 3 cents. Since mid-September, the national average pump price for a gallon of regular is down 47 cents to $1.06. Dozens of gas stations are offering even better deals. At one in Columbus, the price is just 92 cents, and drivers are overjoyed.
Isn't it wonderful? It's like back in the 1970s.
Last summer it was so high, and now it's down to almost half the price it was last summer. It's a treat, Christmas treat, right?
Oil-producing nations are poised to cut production to try to shore up the sinking price of fuel. But the International Monetary Fund predicts that won't bolster prices much because the worldwide economic downturn has slashed demand for energy. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Officials at Motorola Corporation say the company's cutting another 9,400 jobs. That's about 8% of the company's workforce. The cell phone semiconductor maker has now shrunk its workforce by 32% in the past year and a half. I'm Frank Stacio.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ever since September 11th, Americans have been asking, why do they hate us? My guest Bernard Lewis tried to respond to that question back in the September 1990 issue of The Atlantic in a cover story on the roots of Muslim rage. He has a new piece in this month's Atlantic. Last month, he had an article in The New Yorker titled The Revolt of Islam. When did the conflict with the West begin and how could it end? Lewis has spent his life studying the Middle East and Islam. He's a professor emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He has a new book of his translations of classical Arabic, Persian, Turkish, and Hebrew poems called Music of a Distant Drum. He also has a new book that will be published next month titled What Went Wrong? Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response. I asked him, now that the Afghans are so relieved to be free of the Taliban, might the U.S. seem less like a villain and more like a force for good to people in the Islamic world?
Most of the Middle East falls into one of two groups. On the one hand, there are countries with governments which are said to be pro-American and whom we regard as friends and allies. And in those countries, particularly Egypt and Saudi Arabia, the population is fanatically, passionately anti-American, because they regard us as responsible for the tyrants that rule over them. And it's no accident that most of the hijackers came from those two countries. On the other hand, there are countries like Iraq and Iran where the governments are anti-American and where the people, therefore, are very strongly pro-American. It was very remarkable immediately after September the 11th. Thousands of people in Iran spontaneously went out into the streets and held vigils to express sympathy and compassion. This was not organized. On the contrary, the state tried to prevent it. It was a spontaneous expression of goodwill. And I don't have the slightest doubt that the scenes of rejoicing in Afghanistan will look like a funeral compared with what we would see in Iraq and Iran if they were liberated from their present rulers.
Now, you mentioned that, a lot of the extremists come from Saudi Arabia and Egypt because they live under tyrants there. In what way is the Saudi family tyrannical in the ruling over Saudis?
Oh, tyrannical, I think, is too strong a word, but certainly very autocratic. And in the modern age, particularly with modern media and modern communications, people are less tolerant of that than they used to be. And the media have made an enormous contribution to this. I mean, there have always been differences between the rich and the poor, between the powerful and the powerless. But usually the poor and the powerless were very little aware of those differences. Now they see them and hear them every day, thanks to the mass media. And this is a major source of the deep and growing frustration and resentment.
You've said that what lies behind Muslim anger is three centuries of defeat, decline, and impotence in the Muslim world. I know you can't describe three centuries for us, but can you give us a sense of what you mean by that?
Let me try to explain. For the first 1,000 years or so of Islamic history, that is to say, from the career of the Prophet and the advent of Islam in the 7th century, Islam saw itself, and to a large extent, rightly, as the dominant civilization in the world, the most powerful, the wealthiest, the most creative, advancing on all its territorial frontiers, advancing also on all the frontiers of knowledge. There were setbacks. They had conquered Spain. They lost Spain. That was more than compensated by their advances. And as recently, so to speak, as the 17th century, there were still Turkish pashas ruling in Budapest and in Belgrade, Turkish armies besieging Vienna, and North African corsairs raiding the coasts of England and Ireland. And then suddenly everything changed. They were defeated on every battlefield. They lost every war. And not only in war, but they were defeated also not only on the battlefield, but in the marketplace, when suddenly they found themselves being outsold, outproduced by this upstart Western world. Let me illustrate this with an example. Sugar and coffee are both commodities which were unknown in the Western world. They were imported from the Middle East, and they figured prominently in the balance of payment, balance of trade between the Middle East and the Western world. Then the Europeans learnt to grow sugar and to grow coffee in their colonial plantations, and they did it more efficiently and more cheaply than the locals, so that by the 18th century, coffee and sugar are import items from the West and no longer export items to the West. So that by the 18th century, if a Turk or an Arab permitted himself that traditional indulgence, a cup of sweet coffee, the chances were that the coffee came from Java or the West Indies, and that the sugar came from somewhere in Central America and was refined somewhere in Western Europe. And the only thing that was local was the hot water. And by the 19th century, even that ceased to be true because European companies took over most of the utilities. There was this feeling of frustration in a society accustomed to a position of preeminence and indeed dominance. And another point which I think is very important, a society with a very strong sense of history. In this country, if you say of something that's history, you mean it's unimportant, irrelevant, of no value for present concerns. This is not the Middle Eastern view. History is very much present around them all the time. During the Iraq-Iran War, 1980 to 1988, I had occasion to look at the propaganda of both sides. It was full of rapid, passing, incomplete allusions to events in history 1,000 or more years ago. And they didn't need any explanations, and they knew perfectly well that their readers would pick them up and understand them. In the same way, when Osama bin Laden spoke of this shame and humiliation which we have suffered for more than 80 years, people here were rushing around in circles. What happened 80 years ago? What's he referring to? I don't think anybody in the Middle East had the slightest doubt as to what he was referring to.
What was it?
He was referring to the final defeat and occupation of the Ottoman Empire, the last of the great Islamic states.
In your recent writings, you've said that you think that Al-Qaeda and other extremist Islamic groups have caught on in part by working with this victim mentality. Why did they do this to us? Who is the they, and what is the this that they're being accused of having done?
Well, let me try to put this in a historical context.
Yeah.
As I said, during the last 300 years or so, things have gone badly wrong from their point of view, and there is an increasing awareness among all levels of society in all these countries that things have gone badly wrong as compared with what went before and as compared with what is happening in other parts of the world. I mean, they've not only fallen behind the West, they've also fallen behind such new societies as Korea, Taiwan, and so on. So when you become very much aware that things have gone badly wrong, there are two questions you can ask. You can ask, what did we do wrong? In which case, the next question is, how do we put it right? And that is what the Turks have been doing in their slow and painful road to, I would say, a real democracy. The other question you can ask is, who did this to us? And that leads you into a sort of twilight zone of conspiracy theories and neurotic fantasies. And that, I'm afraid, is what the path that many have chosen. Now, the malefactors, those whom they accuse of having done it to them, have varied considerably. It has been the imperialists, and then, of course, there are various candidates for the role. It has been the Jews for quite a number. It has been, on a smaller scale, the communists, and so on and so on. And going back to earlier times, and they accused the Mongols, and they've also accused each other. The Turks accused the Arabs accused the Turks, and so on. Now, America is undoubtedly the prime candidate, because America is what we call the leader of the free world. They wouldn't put it in those terms. They would say the leader or chief of the House of Unbelief. The world is divided into the believers, which means the Muslims, and the unbelievers. And they see this as a competition between the two world religions that has been going on for 14 centuries. The enemy in the past was headed by the Byzantine emperors in Constantinople, the Holy Roman emperors in Vienna, the British and French empires, and so on. Now the United States has inherited that role.
Why is America more the enemy now than it was, say, 30 years ago?
Because America now is the undisputed head of the free world. There is no rival. There is no alternative.
How was it different in the Cold War?
Well, there was a Soviet Union, an alternative power. And, of course, many of them turned to the alternative powers. I mean, during the World War, there was considerable support for the Third Reich. After the end of the war and the Cold War, there was considerable support for the Soviet Union. Now, there is no alternative. They find themselves face to face with the only serious power in the Western world.
Now, you've pointed out how paradoxical it is that when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in the late 1970s, it was the United States that went to the aid of the Afghans who were trying to drive the Soviets out. It wasn't other Arab countries, it was the United States. What kind of sense do you make of that, given what's happening now? Yeah,
it's not paradoxical that the United States went to the aid of the Afghans. What is remarkable is the very limited support that the Afghans got from their Muslim brothers. Even the Organization of the Islamic Congress could only bring itself to vote a very lukewarm condemnation. And at the United Nations, the same thing happened. They were scared of the Soviet Union. Then, of course, came the Afghan wars, and they feel that they were the ones who defeated and destroyed the Soviet Union. And they feel that having dealt with one of the superpowers, they are capable of dealing with the other. They regard the United States as a much easier opponent than the Soviet Union, less ferocious, less determined. And one of the things which comes out very clearly in the writings of Osama bin Laden is not the hatred. I mean, if you ask why do they hate us, you're asking the wrong question. The question is not why do they hate us. They've been hating us for centuries, and the us has varied, but always meaning the world of the infidels. What is new and dangerous is that they no longer fear or respect us, and that is quite clear from Osama bin Laden's writings. And this is why I feel that the events of the last few weeks may have brought a really significant change. Osama bin Laden speaks of the Americans in his various interviews and declarations as paper tigers. They have gone soft. They can't take casualties. Hit them and they'll run. This is a recurring theme. And there's a sort of repeated litany. Vietnam, Lebanon, Somalia. Hit them and they'll run. This was the theme. It was hatred, yes. But the important thing is that the hatred was not restrained by fear or tempered by respect. I think that he and his followers will have changed their minds on that point now.
My guest is historian Bernard Lewis. His new book, What Went Wrong, Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response, will be published next month. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Bernard Lewis. His new book, What Went Wrong, Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response, will be published next month. He's written extensively about the Islamic world. Bin Laden has sent, or at least allowed, people who are his followers to go on suicide missions. And he didn't seem to be bothered at all that some of the hijackers didn't even know what the nature of their mission was and didn't know, even though they understood that they were being chosen for martyrdom, they didn't know that this mission was necessarily that mission that was going to martyr them. What does the Quran have to say about suicide missions. Is there any precedent in the Quran for that type of
none whatever.
Fighting?
On the contrary, the whole Islamic tradition is against suicide. Suicide is considered in the Muslim tradition to be a mortal sin. One who commits suicide forfeits paradise and is doomed to eternal hell. And his punishment in hell will consist of the unending repetition of the act of suicide. I mean, it is one thing to throw yourself to a certain death against a much stronger enemy. It is quite another to die by your own hand. And this is made perfectly clear in Muslim writings. There is a very early Muslim tradition, according to which a Muslim soldier was mortally wounded, was lying on the battlefield dying, and in order to shorten his pain, he killed himself with his own sword. And the Prophet said that God said that, I quote, "My servant has preempted me by taking his own life. He shall not enter paradise." That's not Quran, but it's a very early Muslim tradition. And it does, I think, express the basic Muslim view concerning suicide. The idea that the suicide bomber also can be considered as a martyr on the battlefield and qualify for the rewards of paradise is a very new one. And I would say that in their own terms, these people are taking a big chance on eternity.
Do you think that the Gulf War contributed to the hatreds that have resulted in terrorist attacks against the United States?
Yes, I do. I mean, first of all, the manner of ending the Gulf War. The actual fighting of the Gulf War, no, because it was to rescue two Arab Islamic countries from attack by a third. Kuwait was occupied, Saudi Arabia was threatened, and the United States came in at their request to help them. Nothing wrong with that. But then, in the course of the war, we called on the Iraqi people to rise in rebellion against the tyrant that ruled over them. They did so. And then, after the ceasefire, we sat and watched while Saddam Hussein brutally suppressed these risings, crushed the rebels group by group and region by region, while we sat and watched, and he used the helicopters, which we had thoughtfully allowed him to retain under the terms of the ceasefire. This was a very unedifying spectacle. And the message was, we don't mind what you do to your own people. We don't mind what kind of tyrannical regime you set up, as long as you meet our requirements. Saddam Hussein, for example, to replace him, it was argued at the time, would be dangerous. What we wanted is not a change of regime, but a change of ruler. Change of regime would open up all sorts of new issues and new uncertainties. What we wanted is to replace the tyrant by a more amenable tyrant who would be amenable to our purposes. That made a very bad and very painful impression. It reinforced the feeling among many that the West in general, the United States in particular, does not regard them as civilized human beings with the same rights and aspirations as others, but simply as people of backward cultures only fit to be ruled by tyrants. All that matters is that they should be our tyrants and not somebody else's tyrants. I think that is an oversimplification, but it is not a falsification, as I said before. And there is a lot of evidence to reinforce that impression. I won't say to prove it or confirm it, but to reinforce that impression, certainly.
Bernard Lewis is my guest. He's a scholar of the Arab world, a professor at Princeton University, and author of the new book, What Went Wrong? Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response, that will be published in January. In addition to your new book, What Went Wrong?, you've edited a new book of classical Arabic, Persian, Turkish, and Hebrew poems. The book is called Music of a Distant Drum.
Yes, these are translations, poems that caught my fancy and which I tried my hand at translating into English.
I'm wondering if you could leave us with one of the classical Arabic poems that you translated.
Arabic, no, I don't recall one, but I don't have the book with me, but I can give you a Turkish one.
Sure.
By a 15th century Turkish woman, a quatrain. Woman, they say, is deficient in sense. Therefore, they ought to pardon her every fault. But one female who knows what to do is worth more than 1,000 males who don't.
I'm going to ask you to speculate why that part of the world, by our standards, has gone backwards and not forwards in terms of women.
Why, well, why
women
as you can
are have more covering them even than they used to.
As you can imagine, there's an enormous literature on this subject, from inside as well as from outside. And many different explanations have been offered. There's a Turkish writer called Namık Kemal, in an article published in 1868, uses some very striking images. He says that the reason for our backwardness compared with the West is that we deprive ourselves of the talents and services of half the population, so that our society is like a human body that is paralyzed on one side. I think that's a very striking image and a very accurate one. The position of women in the Western world in pre-modern times, and for that matter in modern times, was very far from one of equality. But it was in most respects incomparably better than that of women in the Middle East. And for one thing, there was no legal polygamy or concubinage. Women had somewhat better property rights in Islamic law until modern times, but in every other respect, they were constrained, repressed, and the society was accordingly impoverished. When Mustafa Kemal Atatürk founded the Turkish Republic, one of his first campaigns was for women's rights. Difficult to imagine anything more improbable than an Ottoman pasha and a general as a campaigner for feminist causes. Nevertheless, he did, and he gave his reasons with true military terseness. He said, and this is in the early 20s, he said, our task now is to catch up with the modern world. We will not catch up with the modern world if we only modernize half the population.
What are your concerns about the post-Taliban government in Afghanistan?
I think they seem to be doing fairly well so far. It's a very difficult country to rule. It's a wild, rugged, mountainous country with a very independent people who have not acquired the habit of submission as so many of their neighbors. A difficult country to rule at the best of times, but much worse now after Soviet occupation, the struggle against it, the wars that followed, and then the Taliban. But I spent a little while in Afghanistan, and I must say I have confidence in the ability of the Afghan people to work things out when they're left to themselves.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bernard Lewis is Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton. His new book of translations of classic Arab, Persian, Turkish, and Hebrew poems is called Music of a Distant Drum. His book, What Went Wrong? Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response, will be published next month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and sponsored in part by Nonesuch Records, featuring composer John Adams' El Nino, an oratorio on the Nativity story featuring Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, Dawn Upshaw, and Willard White, conducted by Kent Nagano. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, an expert on extremist and cult groups, about what might have inspired an American to join the Taliban. And Lifton will share his impressions of the Bin Laden tape. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg offers some choices for Word of the Year. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. From time to time since September 11th, we've checked in with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, an expert on extremist religions, cult groups, and the appeal of apocalyptic thinking. In 1999, he wrote about apocalyptic violence and the new global terrorism in a book about the Japanese cult group Om Shinrikyo, titled Destroying the World to Save It. Dr. Lifton is about to become a visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard University. We called him to talk about two subjects, the Bin Laden tape that was released last week, and John Walker, the 20-year-old American who was found fighting with the Taliban in Afghanistan and could face charges of treason. I asked Lifton why a young American might be attracted to extremist Islam.
John Walker had to be a young man who was a religious seeker, but a very intense one. He was looking for something true and pure in some religious idiom. In a way, he reminded me of some young Japanese I interviewed in relation to their connection with Om Shinrikyo, the fanatical Japanese cult that released sarin gas into the Japanese subways in 95. These weren't inherently bad or evil people. They were people in search of an absolute. And I think there's a kind of fine line between finding what they take to be absolute purity and going over an edge in which they then see everything else in the world as so defiled that it must be destroyed.
According to news reports, John Walker told his mullah, his Islamic spiritual advisor, that he was disappointed that Islam was divided among Sunni and Shiites and other sects. He wanted all Muslims to follow one code, one law, to have an absolute truth.
Yeah, that's consistent with what we're talking about, really, because he was so needy that he wanted something that was absolute, that was totalistic, without any rough edges, without any divisions of the kind that so troubled him. And that suggests to me that his hunger for totalism was particularly intense. And it's unfortunate that nowadays, given the warrior spirit in certain forms of fundamentalism, and as we know, in certain expressions of Islamic fundamentalism, it can become violent. And you can have that jump from the quest for purity or totalism into something like apocalyptic or all-consuming violence.
Now, everybody talks about how we live in a global world, global cultures, global economy. Is this an era of global religion now, too?
That's a very important point, Terry, because what I've come to feel more and more, and this case illustrates it as much as any, you can put it very simply in stark terms. Any religious system or set of beliefs, no matter how bizarre, no matter how absolute, no matter how anything, any such set of beliefs can be available to anyone, anywhere, no matter what its origin. That has to do with what you might call the globalization of religion, not just religion, but of ideas and of feelings and idea systems. You know, I can give you a simple example. It isn't fully appreciated, but Om Shinrikyo, when it wanted to bring down the world, starting with releasing a lot of sarin gas and all that in Japan, its main imagery for its last year or two wasn't Buddhist or Hindu, even though it was mainly a Buddhist and a Hindu cult. It was Armageddon. It was the Christian narrative of Armageddon. So any narrative, any religious belief system can become available to anyone in the world, no matter where it begins.
Do you feel like you're seeing a lot more of that now?
I think we are seeing more of it, and I think we ought to look at it more carefully. I think we have too much of a fear in this country that if we start looking at causes, we'll lose our focus on the wrongness of what was done to us. I don't think that's the case. I think we're perfectly capable of recognizing that something dreadful and even evil was done to us on September 11th, and at the same time recognize the necessity of various elements that went into it. And if we don't do that, if we instead take the lazy way of simply dividing the world into good and evil, we won't really grasp what's going on. We certainly will lose all sense of the interrelationship of these feelings and theologies all through the world. The various fundamentalisms which lead into the possibility of apocalyptic violence are worldwide. You can find them here in America. You can find them in Japan, as I did. You can certainly find them in Islamic fundamentalism. And this mindset, although these are very different kinds of movements, they nonetheless have a lot in common. So we're not talking about, in the case of the Taliban or Islamic violent fundamentalism, we're not talking about something absolutely unique and unrelated to the rest of us.
Did you watch the Bin Laden tape?
I did indeed.
What did you find most striking about the tape?
The simple, ultimate truth of that tape, which maybe hasn't been sufficiently commented on, is it reveals him to be a quiet fanatic. Of course, he's petty enough and he can laugh at things, but he sits there quietly, comfortable in his fanaticism, a little bit New Age-like in style, reciting beautiful poetry because it seems to fit in with this sacred vision and sacred behavior that he's part of. If ever you saw on display a quiet fanatic, you saw that on that tape of Bin Laden.
No, I think this expression of the quiet fanatic is interesting because it seems to be a type that you're acquainted with. Several reporters who have met with Bin Laden and interviewed him have referred to him as kind of shy because he's so quiet. And there seems to be a big difference between calling him a quiet fanatic and calling him kind of shy.
Yeah. Well, he might be a little shy. He's also grandiose and megalomaniac in his fanaticism. You know, a parallel story, for instance, Shoko Asahara, the Japanese guru of Aum Shinrikyo, was described by most of his disciples, at least at the time when they were very dazzled by him, as extremely dignified and quiet, said little, but everything he said had extraordinary power. And then one of these same disciples happened to go to a courtroom, an open court where he could attend, where Asahara was rejected by one of his former closest disciples, who said, "You are not a true guru, you are a false guru." And one could see visibly Asahara collapse from this quiet, confident fanaticism into a kind of near psychotic behavior, bizarre movements of his body, strange words coming out. So the quiet fanaticism becomes a stance that certain gurus can readily sustain because they're functioning well within it. But when something happens to undermine the stance, they may indeed collapse.
So you think there's a bit of theater to it?
There is theater, and all such gurus are performers. There's no doubt about it. They are many-sided. They believe in the religious extremities that they embrace. They feel that they have every right to manipulate other people, in the case of Bin Laden, to not tell some of those on the suicide missions exactly what their mission was to be. So they can see themselves as pragmatic manipulators. They can be religious believers. They can feel themselves to have the right to lie or deceive or cheat. Any of these components, part of their skills in performance and in their own mind, completely justified because it's in the service of a higher spiritual purpose.
My guest is Dr. Robert J. Lifton. He's an expert on extremist religions and cult groups. He's about to become a visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton. He's written extensively about cult groups, extremist religions, and apocalyptic thinking. You know, one thing that a lot of people have mentioned is that Bin Laden and his visitor from Saudi Arabia were talking and laughing and congratulating themselves. And there was no sense, forget remorse, there wasn't even a sense of the gravity of what they'd done. I mean, they seemed to be speaking of it all in a self-congratulatory and fairly lighthearted way. What did you make of
it? It had that. It had a certain tone of happy triumphalism.
Mm-hmm.
We did it. We killed so many of them, and we pulled it off, and they never suspected it, even though those expressions were hardly dignified, and there was almost like giggling, and it certainly was triumphalist. It all was, in a way, grounded in their minds in its sacredness. And interspersed with the giggling and the pleasure was, this sacred moment, and, of course, praise be Allah. And that was serious, because that underlay everything, no matter seemingly lighthearted, no matter how seemingly lighthearted it might be. Once you have some kind of underpinning of sacred necessity, then there can be all kinds of lightheartedness, all the more so when it's been achieved.
In watching the Bin Laden tape, did you feel that the longer Bin Laden was in the company of the Saudi Arabian visitor, who obviously was a great admirer of Bin Laden's, that Bin Laden maybe really started to like soak up the attention he was getting, kind of enjoy an element of sycophancy? What would the word be?
Yeah, that's right. He is sycophantic. I thought of that as you were talking. In a way, that's a certain kind of vulnerability of a guru. Gurus need their disciples even more than disciples need their gurus, and they move into a certain stage of relationship with disciples, which itself is very absolutized, and it becomes a kind of absolute or total guruism. And you could see indications of that on the tape, and partly because it was a very informal, not very dignified scene, it was very blatant as he was eating up the sycophancy. There's no doubt about it.
Can you make sense of how Bin Laden, who believes in a form of religion that harkens back to medieval or pre-medieval times and really opposes modernity in almost every form, how he can believe that and at the same time really want to build nuclear weapons, which is the height of modernity when it comes to armaments?
Almost all the movements that we call anti-modern embrace the accoutrements of modernity. It seems like a contradiction, but it's not entirely fully a contradiction. Somebody has used what is an informative term. They call it reactionary modernism. It was used about the Nazis. The Nazis were anti-modern, and they had this vision of mythical Aryan beings they wanted to return to. But they were early on in embracing every kind of technology of destruction. And they really want to use every single tool or method of the modern world in order to spiritualize the world. And I've noticed in these various cults that I've come into contact with, again, I think of Om Shinrikyo, you know, they use the internet. Each generation of cultic behavior becomes a little bit more knowledgeable about the internet. They use it for what they take to be ultimately spiritual purposes. But they are creatures of our times. Bin Laden has training in engineering, as you know, and as a developer. And these people aren't, you know, are in certain ways as modern as you or I might be.
Have you been following the speculation that Muhammad Atta is gay? And I've even heard speculation that Bin Laden is gay. The implication being, and this is real like psychohistory, but the implication being that this extreme form of homophobia that is a part of their religion, is perhaps forcing them to express their own repressed impulses in a very aggressive way.
Well, I'd be careful about that kind of explanation. I have no idea about their sexuality or whether either or both are gay or is gay. Maybe they're trying to cover something over. If that's the case, and I'm not at all sure it is, but if it were the case, then all you could say, I think, is that their extreme need to cover over an aspect of their sexual inclinations that they find themselves unacceptable could intensify their involvement in this apocalyptic violence. But it would be a mistake to see it as the source of that apocalyptic violence, because the source has more to do with the theologies and the ideologies that we've been talking about. And such ideologies and theologies have been in existence, and I mean of world ending. They've been in existence since the formation of religion itself. They seem to be part of every religion. The difference now is that this kind of world-ending theology can be accompanied by the acquisition of weapons that could literally bring about that world-ending. So if there are other sources of great anxiety or great conflict, such as conflict over sexuality, yes, they could contribute some aspect of intensity, but I'd be very wary of looking at that as the causative factor. It's interesting that there's a new book about Hitler that says just about exactly the same thing. And it's, I think, by focusing on that almost exclusively, I think it's, again, playing down the broader theological and ideological forces that are at issue here.
The American military has been trying to get Osama bin Laden dead or alive. If he's captured or if he's killed, do you think that's likely to end his following? In other words, what happens to a group like his when the leader is gone?
Yeah, it's a big question, and it's hard to answer exactly. I think that if he's captured or killed, I think his following will radically decline, because part of his appeal, his mystical magic, has had to do with his capacity to humiliate the West, which is a big impulse in much of Islam. And even people who don't like his methods and his mass killing have a certain soft spot for him, because he had succeeded in doing that, not just on September 11th, but on three or four prior occasions. If he himself, in turn, is destroyed or humiliated or removed from any capacity for this kind of guruism or leadership, I think some of that guru magic, maybe most of it, disappears. I myself, though, yeah, I'm against the death penalty, even for bin Laden, and I would hope that we bring him to justice in as much an international way as possible, to full justice, but at the same time that if we have any opportunity, we probe his mind. We don't have to make this some world performance in which we give him a stage, but I do think we have to combine confronting him and bringing him to justice with grasping everything we can about him as a phenomenon.
Dr. Lifton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed our talk.
Dr. Robert J. Lifton is about to become a visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard. He's the author of many books, including Destroying the World to Save It, Om Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence, and the New Global Terrorism. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg offers some options for Word of the Year. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. What would the word of the year be for 2001? Jihad, terrorist, or maybe just 9/11? Linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts about this and why the word of the year isn't usually the word of the decade.
Every year since 1991, the members of the American Dialect Society get together at their annual meeting to vote on the word of the year. Last year's winner was Chad. That wasn't a new word in 2000, of course, but it did have a moment of prominence before it slipped back into obscurity. For that matter, neither of the runners-up looks like having legs either. Despite the success of Harry Potter, Muggle hasn't caught on among many people over 12. And we haven't heard much about dot bombs lately, now that the collapse of the internet bubble has been eclipsed by a more general economic devastation. Actually, most of the previous winners haven't fared too well either. The 1999 winner was Y2K, and the winners in earlier years included Millennium Bug, Information Superhighway, and the exclamation not. Back in 1991, the winner was Mother of All, as in Mother of All Battles. And the Society never even considered a lot of the liveliest innovations of the period, like whack, word, and whatever. Of course, there have been some good calls in there as well. The 1995 word of the year was web. And in 1996, the expression don't go there lost out narrowly to soccer mom. And in 1993, the word voted most likely to succeed was the quotative like, as in, I was like, no way. That was a pretty good pick. If like were a stock, you could have made a lot of money buying into it back in 1993. So if I seem to be dwelling on the members' miscalculations, it isn't to disparage their powers of prognostication. They're just trying to have fun, and anyway, they haven't done any worse at picking classics over the years than the members of the Motion Picture Academy have. Millennium Bug may not have been the best choice for Word of the Year in 1997, but it's no worse than Titanic for Best Picture. What this shows, though, is that the words of the year don't usually wind up as the words of the decade or the century. A momentous event can throw a few new words up on everybody's screen for a while, but its lasting effects on the language are usually felt somewhere else. I haven't seen the Society's ballot for 2001, but it's clear that this year's candidates will have a more somber tone. The list is sure to include terrorism, jihad, homeland, anthrax, and Ground Zero. And then there's 9/11 itself. That always sounds to me like the sort of thing a press agent would come up with to describe a product launch date. But whichever of these winds up in the winner's envelope, this is one year when you hope the Society can maintain its record of picking 9 days wonders. It would be nice to think that jihad and anthrax will be trivial pursuit items in 10 years' time, on the order of words from the early 90s like Velcroid and starter marriage. And I certainly hope the word evildoer has disappeared from the American political discourse by then. If not, we'll be living in a very different sort of country. Still, vast events do have their effects on the language, even if they're not the ones that are most obvious at the time. I don't know what word the American Dialect Society would have picked if it had been giving its awards back in 1941. Maybe Open City or Axis or Lend-Lease. In the end, though, most of the enduring words that came out of the early years of World War II were the names of less portentous things: beachhead, foxhole, bloodbath, and scuttle. In fact, most of the really lasting words that entered the language in the early 1940s had nothing to do with the war. Expressions like give somebody a leg up, off the cuff, fuddy-duddy, and burp. It's too early to say whether the events of September 11th will make any lasting contributions like these. One candidate might be weapons-grade, which I've already started to hear people using as a general superlative, as in weapons-grade salsa. But the real linguistic significance of September 11th may have less to do with the words we use than the ones we've stopped using. Americans have suddenly become circumspect about the violent and bellicose metaphors that used to pepper our speech. It'll be a while before Microsoft again accuses a competitor of pursuing terrorist tactics. And people think twice now before they describe a cocktail or a restaurant as killer. And you hope the attacks have discouraged some of the military swagger of modern corporate language, with all its talk of road warriors and scorched earth policies. Granted, it isn't clear how long this new circumspection will last. You can already see the cable news networks straining under the burden of the conversational new order. They're a lot more comfortable with sarcasm than solemnity. And over the long run, Americans are more disposed to make light of their fears than to treat them gravely. In fact, high school kids are already using terrorist as a comic insult. You think of the way Nazi went from a name for Hitler and Goering to the officious soup Nazi of a famous Seinfeld episode. But that took 60 years. You wonder whether September 11th will cast that long a linguistic shadow.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the author of the new book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of The Fiery Cross, a novel by Diana Gabaldon, author of The Outlander Saga. And Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, the story of FBI double agent Robert Philip Hansen. He sold secrets to the Soviets while also betraying his wife, placing hidden closed-circuit cameras in their bedroom so a friend could watch their intimate relations. We talk with David Weiss, author of The Bureau and the Mole. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.